The Psychedologist.
What an honor to host Dr. Michael Yellowbird on the podcast. In this episode, we hear about the cycle of water, how spirit embodies everything, and that is consciousness, that trauma has a consciousness, and that consciousness is shared. It goes beyond the individual. Dr. Yellowbird shares about the clown who can show us that there is humor in death. He also says that Indigenous peoples have safeguards to keep them well and healthy. The conversation turns to the topic of colonization and oppression and how this makes people ill and changes the body and mind. Dr. Yellowbird discusses the collectivist gene and how we can all get back to our ancestral heritage. This is something that I've been working on lately, and I find it very consciousness positive. Another critical point that comes up is the misuse of the term decolonization. Dr. Yellowbird breaks down the stages of settler colonialism, which are exposure, contamination, infection, and assimilation, and the stages of decolonization, purification, renaissance, enlightenment. Decolonization must be done in consultation and relationship with Indigenous people. Dr. Yellowbird is hopeful that we can use Western and Indigenous science to propel people forward. The episode wraps up with some discussion of the medicine wheel, approaching new ideas, medicine, places, cultures, and so on with respect, and being a great observer. So Dr. Michael Yellowbird is dean and professor of the Faculty of Social Work at the University of Manitoba. He is an enrolled member of the MHA Nation, and that is in North Dakota, USA. He has held faculty and administrative appointments at the University of British Columbia, University of Kansas, Arizona State University, Humboldt State University, and North Dakota State University. His research focuses on the effects of colonization and methods of decolonization, ancestral health, intermittent fasting, Indigenous mindfulness, neurodecolonization, mindful decolonization, and the cultural significance of res dogs. He is the founder, director, and principal investigator of the Center for Mindful Decolonization and Reconciliation at the University of Manitoba. He is the author of numerous scholarly articles, book chapters, research reports, and the co-editor of 4 books. I've listed those in the show notes. He's also the co-author of 2 recent books, and I've put in the names of those as well, so you can look them up. I hope that everyone enjoys the great wisdom in this episode. Thank you. Good afternoon, Dr. Yellowbird. Welcome to The Psychedologist.
Thank you.
My pleasure, really. I'd love to start by asking you about what your relationship to consciousness was before or when you were small.
Well, I think consciousness to me really sort of represented, you know, the world that I lived in back home on my reservation, my tribal territory. But let me just say this first, Leah, is that I want to give my land acknowledgement because I am a visitor on the Treaty One territory in Canada, which is the traditional territories of the Cree, the Ojai Cree, the Dakota, Dene, Anishinaabe, and the traditional homelands of the Métis people. So I wanted to make sure I made that acknowledgement, you know, because I'm a visitor on their territory. So getting back to consciousness as a child, I think it's important, I think, for me to let, you know, listeners know that I'm from the 3 affiliated tribes, the Mandan, Hidatsa, and the Arikara people in North Dakota. And we are folks that have long done, had a lifestyle, I should say, that, you know, has been around understanding our consciousness in regard to the connection to the natural world. And a lot of that in my childhood was derived from that place where I did have an opportunity to observe different kinds of ceremonies that had happened, that were happening in the community, different kinds of rituals that elders and spiritual people participated in. And it was really, for me, I think the consciousness as a child then was formed by the relationship that we did have with a much larger world, a spiritual world, a spirit world, to be more accurate. there were a lot of spirits, you know, that people had in terms of guardian, you know, visitors that protected the people, and also helpers to the people. So that was one part of who we were, is the consciousness that we were raised with, all these stories about spirits and about our interactions with spirits, you know, people that, you know, we knew, other people that we didn't know, and spirits that were, you know, sort of the protectors or the guardians of certain places, right? Certain sacred lands, certain sacred waters, those kinds of things. Everything had spirit. I remember just finished a book very recently called Decolonizing Pathways Towards Integrative Healing and Social Work. And one of the stories I wrote about was an aunt of mine, but we called her Grandma Grace. And she came to my house one time, and we had this long conversation. It was after I got out of graduate school. I finished my Master of Social Work degree. And we had conversation about, you know, the world around us. We had these conversations all the time. So at one point, you know, in our conversation, I was talking about how one of my professors, who was an Indigenous professor, the first one I had ever had, you know, in my academic career, had told me that, you know, it was so important for us to maintain our connection with our beliefs, our stories, our songs, our traditions. So when I was telling my aunt this, she said, and he said, to bring these things into the work that we do, you know, all the time. So when I told her that, she said, come with me. So I went with her, we drove down to the waters, and she said, maybe this is what your professor was talking about, because she wanted to know if he was Indigenous. I said, yes, he was. Very smart guy. And so she said, you know, Michael, our people believe that, you know, these waters have a sense of consciousness. They think, they feel, and they need to be protected, just like all things need to be protected. And so you know that your parents have told you this, that there are spirits that guard these waters and guard the life in the water. Have they told you that? I said, oh, yes, of course. And she said, it's up to us, you know, to maintain our sense of connection to these places. That's part of our, she didn't say consciousness, but this, you know, that's what sang to me, she said. And so what we do is we make offerings to this water, because this water is alive. And so what she did at that point is that she reached into this pouch she had. She took out whatever it was she had. I don't know what it was. I never did ask her. She held it above the water, and she said this prayer, and she prayed, you know, and then she finished, and she turned to me. She said, you know, I said these words, she said, that so this water will have, take pity on us. This water, you know, this water can take life, can give life, and can remake life. That's the power of water, she said. And so it's the first time I had heard it said in that way. Is that this cycle of water, you know? I thought, okay. And so it was times like that, you know, when I was a young man at that time, I wasn't a child, but I had heard these stories. And then I started to understand as I got older what the stories were about. It took me a while to kind of mature into those kinds of things. And then to actually have the teaching take place for me again when I was an adult, so it manifest, you know, in my sense of who I was, my consciousness, and that sort of thing. So there, you know, spirit embodied everything, plants, the wind, you know, the sun, you know, the stars, was, that's kind of what it was for us, was consciousness, right? That was like, it was all part of who we were. And it was difficult to think out without those things, right? Difficult to kind of make decisions without those kinds of things. One of the things I do remember as a child was there were situations where we had things like sacred clowns in our community that would come to our social and ceremonial dances, and they would perform certain kinds of rituals that would encourage the people, you know, to participate with them, right? So we'd all sort of move in the same kind of place, you know, thinking about what they were trying to teach us. And it wasn't until years later, you know, I saw this as a child, dressed, all these clowns come in a certain kind of way. And then it wasn't until years later when I was at a Sundance. I was a Sundancer for many years. I was talking to one of my grandfathers who passed into the spirit world a few years back, and some of my uncles, and asked him about these clowns. And he said, you know, that's part of who we are, right? That they tell us that, you know, like at a funeral, for example, when everyone's grieving and crying, the clown will come in and the clown will do all these backwards things, right? These contrary things. And that's part of our consciousness, right? Is that the clown reminds us that, you know, there's humor in death, but after death, after the sadness, you know, you'll go back to who you are again. And so I said, oh, these indigenous people are very brilliant, man. They had all these built-in safeguards to keep us well and healthy. And that was part of our consciousness. As a child, I saw those kinds of things. So it was those different kinds of things that, as I said, I was exposed to as a child. And then as I got older, I began to make sense of them. I have a lot of examples like that, but I don't want to spend all my time talking about that. But so seeing the ritual, being in ritual, listening to the stories, and seeing that the consciousness was not just here with us, the consciousness was with everything. And our consciousness was shared, you know, by things that people would say, well, how could you share consciousness with a plant or with its water? Or how could you share consciousness with, you know, these things? And in the same book, I did write about trauma, right, and memory work, and how part of the consciousness of trauma, trauma has consciousness, right? And so this story I tell about how my son was thrown from a horse, and how his grandfather, my father, told me to go talk to his grandfather to do this particular ceremony. So he did. He took the trauma away from my son for the ceremony. And then after that, he said, now let's go see the horse. So then he went, saw the horse, and he said, the horse, you know, has this consciousness, right? It's connected to ours. And so we have to kind of take the trauma away from the horse. So after he was done doing that, I thought, okay, we're done. He said, now let's, where did this happen? And so we told him, so we walked to this place where it happened. And then he said, all this area experienced the trauma. Something was not balanced here, right? Because he had asked me, you know, why the horse had thrown my son. And I gave him all these answers because he kind of did an assessment, you might say, right? So then at that point, what he did, and I read in the story, is he began to talk to the earth, to the plants, all these things that had witnessed this, right? And then he, you know, told them, you know, in his own language, it was the Mandan language. He told them, you know, these different things about, you know, what had happened, and they had witnessed this, to try to bring them back into balance. And I said, okay. And he said, it's people forget to do that. He said, if something happens somewhere, I remember him telling me this one time at a Sundance, let's say someone gets assaulted on a street, or maybe they get murdered, or, you know, something bad happens. He said, white people, they take that person off the street or whatever. He said, but what they don't do is they don't go and cleanse that area. It's like washing the blood off of that, right? There's this, he didn't call it psychic energy. That's, you know, something else, right? But he says that disturbance exists in that place. He said, you know about that, Mike. He said, you walk into these places and you can feel it. Can you feel it? Have you been to this place, that place? We talked about that. I didn't write it in the story. I said, oh, yeah. I said, can you feel that? I said, yeah. He said, these places. He said, that's what it is. There's these disturbances that exist in these places. So these are things that I had heard as a child, right? Places you don't go. There's things you don't say. There's, you know, at certain times there are, you know, these restrictions and protocols you have, right? That's part of your consciousness, right? It's like, okay, you have to have respect for these things. And it wasn't, again, as I said, from being a child until I got older to begin to understand how these things are embodied, you know, in a very, very subtle way, you know. And if you don't stop and really engage yourself in that, you lose the subtlety of that connection, right, that exists. So these are a number of things that I observed as a kid, and I thought, wow, this is really interesting. Again, like I told, like I mentioned before, you know, consciousness is shared. You know, it's kind of shared in this huge place. So It's not just with an individual or with individuals. It goes beyond that, right? I meant to say earlier that, you know, we had the stories with dogs and horses and animals too as well, when we're close to those, that even the people today, you know, who say, well, you know, you've got a dog. Yeah. Does your dog feel like a member of the family? People say, oh yeah, this, you know, do you buy your dog a birthday present? You know, people say, yeah, we do. Right. So that's part of their consciousness, that this being is, you know, this kind of close to them. So if you can imagine indigenous people who spent all their time out, you know, in the elements close to the earth, that's part of their consciousness. And the earth had its consciousness. The waters had their consciousness, and animals have their consciousness. The stars have their consciousness. And so ours is sort of embedded, you know, embodied in all of those things. So these are the stories we tell children, right? I got a lot of books behind me in my library here, and there are a lot of traditional stories that talk about that, you know, with indigenous people, how they're, you know, how we're related to these things. So.
Thank you. And then at some point you decided to, well, you mentioned you went to grad school. So how did you decide to go travel the path that you did in academia? And you're a professor as well, aren't you?
I am. Yeah, I am a professor. I've been a professor for many years. My first teaching job was in 1992 when I went to the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, BC. I was became a member of the faculty there at the School of Social Work. So I've been, just like my hunter-gatherer nomadic genes that I have, I've been at many different universities in Canada and the United States doing my work. So I guess what really sort of moved me in the work that I do now around decolonization and around neurodecolonization and around mindfulness I began to understand how settler colonialism and oppression, the loss of land and territory, the loss of lives, the loss of dignity of people really had very devastating results for indigenous people around the world. And a lot of that, of course, was due to the colonization of our territories by settlers who came in and, you know, committed genocide. And then, of course, they, you know, disappeared us. They eliminated the native, you might say, from the landscape, from the historical record, from the, you know, discourse, the narrative. History, all these things we were eliminated from. So being relegated to something of the past, you know, and also to have many different kinds of past and current crimes committed against your people, then I began to see how this colonization continued to take a toll on people in the past. And when people begin to lose their culture and begin to become more integrated into Western society, they got even sicker, right? Even sicker because, you know, many of us are hunter-gatherer populations. You know, we didn't evolve to be so quickly thrown into, you know, a cosmopolitan or a metropolitan area with all, you know, all the diseases and, you know, and chlorinated waters and all this. You can eat any kind of food you want to eat anytime. These are refined carbohydrates. So we get all these diseases. And of course, when you break up people like that who have a collectivist culture, they even have collectivist genes called serotonin transporter genes, what keeps them healthy is being together as a tribe. Right? You break them up, you take their children away like the government did in Canada and the United States. You take their children away, you forcibly take the kids away, put them into these boarding schools. Then you begin to cause an epigenetic response in the body that, you know, depression sets in, anxiety sets in, isolation sets in because they're not around their people. And when this particular gene is not activated, this collectivist gene, the serotonin transporter gene is not activated, then people begin to suffer the consequences of this environment. So I saw a lot of that growing up. I saw a lot of, really healthy, you know, things growing up. I saw a lot of death, a lot of destruction in our communities. People, you know, using substances and also violence, upticks in violence and all these different kinds of things. So at that point, I realized, you know, the colonization, you know, was ongoing, had never stopped. And so I began to think about how colonization was affecting the way our whole bodies, really. But I started looking at first neurodecolonization, which was looking at how colonization began to shape and change the function and structure of our brain, and what it did to our neurochemistry, how it activated, you know, things like, you know, that are these adrenaline-like factors that, you know, made us more anxious and anxiety-ridden, depressed, more suicidal, and how oppression did that too as well. And start looking at all these different factors, and then realize that one of the things that seemed to be make the most sense to me was that getting people back to their ancestral state, you know, which is meant they were closer to their genetic history or heritage, so that they would eat in order to heal, they need to eat the foods they ate. They needed to be around the people that, you know, they loved and cared about, tribal people. They needed to kind of live the lifestyle. And of course, what they really needed to do then was to engage in different kinds of ceremonies that would help the healing process, right? So we know that some of the research now in Western science and indigenous science says that when people engage in activities that help to take away the chronic stress and the anxiety, then molecular decolonization occurs. Well, what does that mean? Well, it means at the molecular level, there are certain things like telomeres at the end of our chromosomes that get very, very short, right? They get shortened and when they get too short, you know, we get the diseases of aging, right? All these diseases of aging, we die early, we get cancers and diabetes, all these chronic disorders. But when we take people, let's say Aboriginal people in Australia, we take them and put them back them in the bush, we put them on an ancestral diet, they lose weight, their mental health improves. And if we were to take a look at their blood work and look at their telomeres at the end of their chromosomes, we'd see they've grown, which means then they're thriving, right, rather than dying. So these are things I started to look at very closely and used evolutionary biology as a framework to begin to understand the evolutionary traps that exist in society today. So that took me to this whole thing around neurodecolonization, as I said. What kind of mindful decolonization, do I call it? What kinds of things do we need to do to decolonize ourselves from all these aspects of colonialism that are very harmful? So that's kind of what my work has been about right now. So,
And I'm aware that sometimes people use the word decolonize and they sort of throw it around, and there are even situations where it's like an oxymoron, like a decolonized museum or university, where these things are like inherently colonized.
Yeah,
is that right?
So yeah, there's a lot of misuse of the term decolonization. It's kind of one of those words that's become a kind of a metaphor, right? It's become one of those, you know, terms that people like to use because it sounds, you know, very cool to use the term decolonization, right? But when we think about decolonization, I think about it in terms of when you have one group from an outside coming in, invading another group, right? There's this initial stage of colonization and invasion. And of course, once they invade that group, right, which is like settlers coming into the land of indigenous people, you know, they invade. And then next thing, you've got this deadly contact that happens, you know, just like COVID-19. It's spread, you know, the ideas, the beliefs, and the values of the settlers come in. Cut down this forest, you know, dam up this river, you know, let's bulldoze this mountain, all those kinds of things that happen, and they begin to bring in those ideas and values and beliefs, and that's kind of the period of where your first contact, and then that's the contamination period, right? They're contaminated. So when you force those ideas on people, they get sick. The same thing would happen to any people in Africa that are still hunter-gatherer populations if you came in. And we see that today. People come in, they bring their, you know, coke products. They bring their, you know, ideas like religions and things like that to people that, you know, this is not who they are, right? They don't, you know, pray to one God in heaven. They pray, you know, their belief is these, you know, their church is all these different kinds of things that exist in the environment. just like indigenous people. So there you got the exposure, the invasion, then the contamination. And then you have the next period, which is you have the period then where the infection sets in, begins to kill people, right? Just like COVID-19, exposure, contamination, then the infection. That's what settler colonialism is like. Then people begin to die. They begin to die. They begin to wither away, getting all these diseases. Then the final stage of the model of colonization then is then people learn to live with some of the colonization. They learn to live with the perverse ideas and the values and those kinds of things. They live within those, you know, those ideas, maybe not necessarily practicing them, but they live within those kinds of things. But those things dominate then their world at that point. And that's when we're colonized. You know, an analogy I always give is like when settlers first came in and they pushed native people off their land and gave them, you know, then they exposed them to things like sugar and refined processed foods. You know, they ate those and then they got sick. They got obese and they, you know, they had, their pancreas, you know, was overwhelmed and they, you know, they became insulin resistant. And then they got diabetes, right? So that's the third stage if they didn't die from it, right? So then how they got colonized then was that Western science then came up with insulin. Give them insulin, right? So rather than go back and change the way they live, now they take insulin. Right? So that's the colonization of people. So it's the same thing with an idea. Rather than go back to your own idea, you know, you remain colonized and use the ideas of the settler in the Western. So decolonization is kind of three part. That's colonization. Decolonization is three part. I use these three concentric circles. One is, first thing is there's this purification period. All the things that harmed you, that are harming you, you have to identify those things, you know, and begin to, you know, get rid of those things, right? Purify yourself from those things. The next part of the model is that there's a period of renaissance. The renaissance is, let's go back to who we are and live like our ancestors used to live, right? In these different ways. Well, it makes perfect sense from an evolutionary and genetic standpoint, because many of us have particular genes that that express in a Western environment that don't express in an ancestral environment, meaning that, you know, we won't get diabetes, right? We'll get some buildup of fat, you know, but when the next starvation or when food is not there, then the fat goes away, we're lean again, right? So we've got those kinds of genes. In a Western world where we've got ad libitum eating, where you can eat all the time, eat all the time, eat all the time, then we go back and we continue to eat and eat and eat, you know, a lot of us do, and then we end up with diabetes or some sickness. So that the idea then is to, the Renaissance is bring back those ways that, you know, understanding who we are. Then the third phase of decolonization is this, right? Third is the enlightenment period, where we begin to use Western and indigenous sciences and knowledge to kind of continue to propel indigenous people forward, right? So that's the model, what it looks like. So decolonization then really is those stages. But really what it means, decolonization, is that people have come and invaded your territory and they've taken away from you, right? And they've substituted something less. And so decolonization is about repatriation. No one can decolonize in Turtle Island or in the Western Hemisphere unless they're in, you know, unless they're indigenous people, because everyone else is a settler, you know, unless you're indigenous. And so indigenous or decolonization then means repatriation. It means give us back our land, give us back our resources, give us back our, you know, our mountains, give us back, you know, this territory, all this stuff that was taken away. So it's not like, you know, you can decolonize your coffee or decolonize yoga or something, right? That's very different. I mean, that's something, you know, that's maybe kind of an anti-oppressive practice people are talking about. They're not talking about decolonization because, you know, decolonization, like I said, is like, it's an understanding of repatriation. You know, people invaded, they took away from you, and you as the indigenous people are living on this plot of land with all these, you know, restrictions, and your rights have been violated. Everyone else outside of that is benefiting from that. not equally. Some people are not benefiting equally from the quote American dream. Some people are actually, you know, at the bottom of that. But, you know, it's the idea that decolonization is, in my viewpoint, is only something that indigenous people, that relates to indigenous people, right? So if you want to decolonize your coffee or decolonize your yoga, that doesn't make any sense to me, right? In fact, if you say, well, let's decolonize yoga, then what you do is you take it back and take it back to where it came from, you know, repatriate it back to where it came from, in India or wherever it came from, right? So that's a common misconception about decolonization, is that people just use it, sort of throw it out, you know, and it becomes a metaphor. It doesn't really have any meaning to it. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I guess I'm thinking about, you know, some people say we are all indigenous. Like, if you trace it far enough back, all settlers originally were indigenous people living in connection with nature and the spirit of the land and with their own ancestral practices. What do you say when settler people want to learn the practices of indigenous people where they're living, or maybe, you know, I think a lot of people are interested in ayahuasca now and they're fascinated by the Shipibo people in Peru. So they want to learn these lineages. Should they try rather to find the lineages that they genetically come from as best as they can?
You know, I think, you know, that makes sense. I think, you know, when you look at the history before Europeans and before other folks came here, you know, I mean, there were brief periods when they say that, you know, Norwegians or Vikings made a small stand in the Western Hemisphere for a bit, for a short period of time. But other than that, there really hasn't been any evidence of any other group being here besides indigenous people. And if you look at the evolutionary history, that's traced back to, you know, like two or three common mothers of indigenous people, right, that have been here for, you know, for thousands, tens of thousands of years. I just, one of my colleagues published a book about indigenous people and ancient indigenous people here in the Americas. I forget the name of the book. So there's some evidence that, you know, people have been here for 130,000 years, which, you know, is unheard of, really. Would change the whole course of human migration patterns, right? But the point of saying that is that people have been here for a long period of time. And what they did with one another is they began to not only be related with each other genetically after such a long period of time, just like other indigenous people were, but they began to, you know, exchange material. They began to exchange, you know, DNA. They began to exchange resources, ideas, technology. That's all pretty clear when you start looking at, you know, a lot of the work that's been done, is that you find that there was a great network of trading going on for a long period of time in Turtle Island. You know, people from the coast were trading all the way into the interior, all the way up to Alaska, all the way down to Terra de Fuga in South America. So the purpose of saying that is that there is, for indigenous people, at least at some level, this common denominator of relationship, right? And they came here and they developed to such a degree that they didn't have the same diseases as Europeans did, right? They were free of infectious diseases, and so they also developed ideas that were not thought of in different parts of the world before Europeans thought of them, like the concept of zero was thought of by the Chinese and the Persians, and also in Mesoamerica by the Mayans, I believe. You know, that concept didn't hit Europe for a few hundred years after that, right? So people were already engaged in these different kinds of things, and there are these general markers that exist around Turtle Island to show that there's this moral and spiritual convergence between all these groups of people. And one of them is the medicine wheel. So we see ancient medicine wheels that exist, and we see these different kinds of, carvings and paintings on rocks, right? We see those kinds of things. And as you look at them, you study those, you'll say, well, these ancient people, man, this is kind of like their calling card. they weren't just drawing them for, you know, white anthropologists to discover, you know, 5,000 years later. Now, man, this was their message to other groups. This is who we are. This is, and then people would decide, well, we're in their territory. Let's go exchange. Let's go meet them. Let's go whatever we do, right? So these are things that, you know, the racist Western science has kept out of the mainstream thinking, that, you know, there were different kinds of civilizations that existed here, different kinds of activities that were going here, and different exchanges of people that were going here. So when people are coming here, they're, you know, wanting to learn about indigenous ways of life, you know, and that's fine. But I think it's very loaded in that way, because you have a lot of different indigenous people, you know, elders, myself included, I'm an elder, that, you know, are a bit skeptical of how these things are handed out to people and how people get access to these kinds of things. Now, it's up to tribes, you know, to kind of to sort of police that, right, themselves, and say, you know, this is who we are. We don't want people in our territory. It's like COVID-19 right now. It's a classic case. A lot of tribes have shut their borders so that people can't, from the outside, can't come in, right? Even other tribes, right? Because they want to maintain the integrity and the well-being of their communities. It's the same thing with plants, with medicine, with ideas, right? If you can trust people that come in, they're not gonna take these ideas, they're not gonna take them and then violate your intellectual property, you know, and then sell it, right, and then claim it and copyright it, right? That's a very different kind of thing. So this has been a long, long history with indigenous people and settlers, you know, coming in, taking the land, you know, taking the ideas, the medicine, the symbols. You know, here you're talking about taking anything you could take from indigenous people and misuse it to change it to without someone's permission. And then to make it into something maybe it was never meant to be. Now, I know, and I'm not static by any means, you know, or do I believe, you know, that that things don't change. But I think the idea is that there's at least some kind of mutual sort of respect both ways, you know, so that settlers are not coming and taking. So I think that's the difference. I think are there respectful ways to do it? Of course there are, right? Should everyone take this particular medicine or this, psychotropic drug or whatever it is, or psychedelic drug or whatever? Probably not, right? It's not meant for some people, right? Are there other people that it's meant for? Probably. I don't know. I mean, that's the thing. It doesn't, I'm not qualified to answer that, but I know from walking the path for a long, many, many years, it does require, you know, I wouldn't go to anybody, you know. I mean, I've been around ceremony for a long time. I wouldn't just go to any shaman or medicine man and say, teach me this, right? I mean, that's foolish, right? You want to know what you're getting out of, the relationship. You want to know that it's someone who, you know, you can trust. It has a sense of spiritual and moral and, you know, human integrity, right? So, and you know, there's a lot of tricksters that exist in the world. I'm not just saying, you know, they're all among the settlers. There's a lot of tricksters among all of us. So we have to be very careful about where we walk. And people that are too anxious, it's like, you know, it's like the saying, it's not the trap that killed a rat. It's the love of cheese, right? And I think that's the idea when you think about that. I mean, that's wisdom. That's wisdom, right? It's like, you know, if that's what you love, is you love the expanded mind, or if you love, you know, feeling this way or that way, then, you could pay the consequences. One of the things I'll mention real quickly is that I don't know if you recall this, Leo. There was a story maybe about, geez, maybe it's 10 years ago now, where this white guy, he had some kind of warrior sort of workshops in Arizona, where he was bringing people into his sweat lodges, and he brought, you know, groups of people, and they paid him like $10,000 a head for a weekend to go in these sweat lodges. And he was using these native ceremonies. I don't know how he ever got access to them or what he did, but he ended up killing three people, you know, putting them in sweat lodges, and you know, they died from heat exhaustion or strokes or whatever it was. So I think he went to prison for a little while, and then he got out after 3 years or whatever. I'm not sure whatever happened to him. Look him up on the web. I can't even remember his name right now. But that's kind of an example. And I'm not saying that, you know, that's never happened, you know, with indigenous people. Like I said, tricksters are all over the place. So I think that's the thing is to be, you know, careful whenever you're partaking of any kind of substance or any kind of idea or anything outside of your own reality and your own culture, right? You know, move slow. So.
Yeah, definitely slowly. Yeah, tricksters and clowns and all of that. is there anything that, well, you said that you're an elder now. Is there anything that you didn't know when you were younger that you know now that you would share?
You have a long talk show for that, you know, a long podcast, you know. No, I think that's that's the beauty, I think, of you know, being gifted to live another day and another day and another day after that. I think sometimes when you pursue the medicine or the knowledge, you know, it's very elusive, right? Sometimes when you don't want it, it comes to you. And other times when the conditions are right, it comes to you and you receive it, you know, in a way that makes it more powerful and you embody it at a greater, at a much deeper level, right? So I think for me, I think the thing I probably I've learned most, you know, things that I wish I would have known along the path is that I wish that some of the things I would have done is I would have talked to my elders more, which I attempted to do. There's some folks have so much knowledge, right? And they're just waiting to give that knowledge. But we as a society have just completely ignored a lot of people who have such great wisdom, have been through so much, right? And I think that's one of the things I learned about as a child. I had teachers. I had, you know, elders around me. But as a kid, we were going through this time, a shift in our communities, in our culture, where, you know, we were being shifted into, you know, being assimilated into Western culture. And elders then became figureheads, and our teachers then became white school public teachers, or, you know, Christian, you know, or priests or nuns or those kinds of things. Those became our teachers. And they had a very, very different kind of curriculum, you might say, a very, very different vision of what it meant to be a person, or who we were as people, or, you know, who we were supposed to be as people. So I think that's the thing is, for me, I've spent a lot of time doing that. I go back to stories all the time now that I wish I would have listened to more carefully. And the stories make so much more sense, you know. And in my life, the things that I do, I mean, I live as much as I can an ancestral life in different ways. And when I read about some of our ancestors or some of our relatives who live particular kinds of ways, it makes so much sense. I mentioned to you earlier, before we started the podcast, that I'm doing this class with the Engage Mindfulness Institute. I've been doing meditation for, over 45 years now. And what's really interesting about it is that as I look at Tibetan Buddhism and I look at, you know, these different styles of meditation, I find, you know, or Hinduism, I find these different kinds of ideas that run parallel to a lot of indigenous teachings. So one of the things the story that I heard when I was younger about one of my grandfathers, his name was Kaka Naksano, which means the ghost, or the crow who is a ghost, right? And it's one of my grandfathers. So he was very well known for going and sitting in among the bones and the bodies of people who had died in our villages long, long ago. And it's something that's been written about. And when I first came upon this idea of the charnel grounds of Tibetan Buddhism, where you can't bury your dead underground because it's frozen there a lot of times of the year, so you leave the bodies out there, so the vultures and the wild dogs and the animals eat them, and the worms do, and the same thing, you know, with the the Brahmins, you know, who get to be buried in these really elaborate coffins. And then you've got the untouchables that whose bodies are just scattered in this ground, the charnel ground, where all this people are wailing and dying and whatever. So I said, wow, that's really an interesting idea that people in this particular exercise try to do, they visit the charnel grounds. And I said, wow, that's pretty cool. I said, because that's something that, you know, my grandfather, the Crow Ghost, did. You know, he would go out there, and his consciousness, of course, was he wanted to commune with the spirits and the deceased who were there to give messages, right? So he would sit there among all this, right? And of course, he probably felt groundlessness. You know, I'm not grounded because I'm in another world. I'm in a spiritual world that, you know, I'm foreign to this world, right? So he had to acknowledge the spirits and go in there. So when I see those kinds of things in my culture, and I hear the stories of elders that did these kinds of things, that have these, you know, these mirrors around the world of other indigenous people doing these kinds of things, I think, oh, okay. These are things, not that we didn't take seriously, not that we didn't want to remember, but these were things that were actually taken away from us and discouraged us. We were discouraged from understanding this stuff, you know, by white school, you know, public Western education systems, by Western, you know, Christian religions and government and those kinds of things. It was considered to be primitive, backwards, savage, all these different kinds of things. So now it's kind of interesting to see settlers kind of wanting to have a taste of that savagery, right? I mean, they're kind of like, give me a taste of that. Yeah. And so I guess that's what I think when I, you know, things, not that I didn't listen to them because I didn't want to, but because I was, you know, made to be fearful of them or, you know, pushed away from those kinds of things. So it's a different circumstance in that way. You know, I think a lot of us now, when I talk to a lot of my peers and my nephews and grandsons, and when they ask me things about that, I talk about those kinds of things to them. And I say, you know, it's all in our culture. It's all in our history. These are things that we did, right? And there, and here's the path. This is how you do it, right? And so, and those words, really interesting too, Leah, is that the words never go away. They're embodied, you know, like in the space. They're embodied in the wind. They're embodied in all these places that when someone's, and again, I wrote in this book that we finished, when my grandfather's name was Plenty Fox, it was my dad's grandpa, his name was Plenty Fox. He would tell my dad stories when my dad was little. My dad, you know, would be about 96 years old today if he had, you know, was alive. But he would tell my dad stories about, see that plant? That plant has emotions. That plant, you know, he would sort of put it in that thing, and he said, or you see that mother fox there taking care of her babies? Some of those babies are like you. She said, they don't behave, you know. They don't listen, you know. And so he'd tell me stories, and then he'd sing the song for that. And then my dad would kind of tell us that knowledge. We'd think about it. But these were people that were just great observers, right? So then when we would tell these stories, right, tell these stories to people outside of our community, would say, well, that's a fairy tale. That's, you know, that's not real. That's kind of, you know, that's a very simple way of thinking, or that's primitive, or whatever it is. So anyway, that's kind of the thought about, you know, these things are embedded, you know, in our worlds that are still there for us to draw from. So.
I wish that we had so much more time in this conversation. I'm sad to be rounding about to the last question here, but as it goes, would you share a consciousness hack with us, or talk to us about consciousness hacks? I think you have a really good wisdom on this one, as you have had on everything else.
I think you know, my most favorite consciousness hack now, today, is I'm a runner, and I'm pretty fast yet. I can run hard, you know, and I think that's kind of one of the things, you know, that about running is that it's not anymore like I used to think. I used to run really hard and fast like I was when I was a young man, but I can still run. But how I hack my consciousness in this way is that I know that when I run, running and movement, you know, changes this kyanetic acids in my body, you know, and they change and they change them from these toxic ones into ones that help prevent depression, right? So we know that from Western science that when you run, you've got this kyanetic acid that changes from one to another one, then it changes to one that, you know, helps prevent actually depression. So we know that. We know that we were born to move as human beings, as indigenous people. And, you know, I come from a community of people that were runners and still indigenous people that run. And running was a ceremony too as well. So when you run hard, you run long, but not too fast, you know, you also raise up the endocannabinoids in the brain. You've got your own system of endocannabinoids, right? And that in itself begins to raise my level of consciousness as I see things, right? And feel my connection to things. And what supercharges that for me is when I sing a running prayer song. So I run along and I sing this song, you know. Right now I'm not running outside because I'm living in Manitoba right now. It's cold out, but I used to run in the cold all the time. So now I've got my treadmill in my garage here. But I run and I sing this song. And the song that I sing, I'm singing about, you know, my connection to everything. And my feeling my body, feeling my emotions, feeling my breath, right? And what that does for me is that not only raises my endocannabinoids and mediate my kyanetic acids in my body, but it also pushes up my brain-derived neurotrophic factor, my BDNF, which increases, you know, neurogenesis. I grow more neurons in my brain. And, of course, I've mentioned long-term potentiation as I do that, you know, the neurons that fire together, wire together kind of thing. So all those movements, thinking about it in a spiritual way, in a sacred way, and as I sing this sacred song as I run, then, you know, opens me up. My emotions open up, right? I don't, everything is built in already. I don't need to take anything from the outside. I just need to kind of move till I get to that sweet spot. And that's one of my favorite hacks right now. Another favorite hack is fasting. I do a lot of fasting. They call it intermittent fasting, right? I've done that for years. But I'm also a long-term faster. I've fasted for weeks at a time sometimes. And I notice the same thing happens, right? Well, what happens to me in particular, because I've had my microbiome sequenced, is that my microbiome changes. I get a population explosion of a bacteria called Acromantia municipalia, which is these little, I call it the great circle of life that lives in my belly, right? And this is my new great circle of life. I've got all these species of bacteria and fungus and so on that live inside of me. It's life, right? And I try to take care of that life. When I fast, I have an explosion of these, you know, Acromantia that makes me leaner, makes me, you know, stronger. And these are guys that fast and girls that fast with me. These are the bacteria that fast with me. They're constantly communicating with me. So I've learned how to communicate, you know, in that way. So get this now: when I run, and I sing, and I fast, that's my consciousness hack, and that's something that indigenous people have always done. We've had running societies that ran, you know, on empty stomachs after hours and hours of fasting, you know, maybe days of fasting, that sing the sacred songs, recognize all of the life in the world around us. And we are, you know, moving in this way. So now I know a bit more about it because now we harbor this great circle of life within us, right? And that has its own consciousness. So its consciousness has to touch my consciousness, and it does when I'm running. And so it's all, those are a couple of my favorite hacks anyway. So
thank you so much, Dr. Yellowbird. That comes to the end of our time, is there any last thing you'd like to share?
It's like one of those, the world that we're in now. I've got another call I've got to do, so I appreciate the time and appreciate any comments folks have. So,
great. I'll put links to your book and to the Engaged Mindfulness Institute and everything in the show notes.
The Psychedologist is Consciousness Positive Radio. Find us everywhere podcasts are hosted. For more information, visit us on Facebook or online at thepsychedologist.com.